And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 6 o'clock, and coming up next is Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs. Stay tuned.
KBOO is preparing for our legendary book and record sale happening on Sunday, September 14th at the Volunteers of America building, 537 Southeast Alder Street in Portland. We're accepting donations of books, comics, LPs, CDs, DVDs, VHS, and cassette tapes, and all donations are tax deductible. Your discards are another person's treasure, and all sales benefit your community radio station, KBOO. So bring those donations down to the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, during our business hours. For more information, please contact Jesse, 503-231-8032, extension 213, or online via email, volunteer@kboo.org. That's the annual book and record sale on Sunday, September 14th.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the White Bear Polar Tundra album release show on Saturday, September 6th at 9 p.m. Opening bands include The Great Hiatum and Snow Roller. White Bear Polar Tundra stands for Environmental Progress with a Conscientious DIY Ethic, and their debut album, Strikes Back, is their effort to create progressive, head-turning music. This show is playing at Alhambra Theater, located at 4811 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information about this KBOO co-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon State Fair, Dia de la Familia, inviting you and your family to come out on Sunday, August 31st in Salem. A celebration of Latino culture, Dia de la Familia includes live Latin music, food, mariachi, ballet folklorico, face painting, and the Shemikra Community College women's soccer team at the Kids Kick Camp.
As we come marching at the dawn of the day, darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
Welcome to Bread and Roses. Bread and Roses is a collective of women-identified radio activists bringing you feminist news and public affairs programming every Friday at 6 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM. Women have had this forum on KBOO since 1978. That's 35 years. We always welcome new collective members, so if you would like to host, produce, or engineer with us, contact KBOO's volunteer manager. Her email is volunteer@kboo.org. You can also find us on the web, kboo.fm/breadandroses. There you can listen to past shows, share comments, or show ideas. And of course, you can find us on Facebook, KBOO, Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo.
And I'm Leanne Kranz. Tonight, we talk about the role and responsibility of white men in leadership positions. To understand white male privilege, white male culture, and be full diversity partners in the workplace and community. We welcome in the studio representatives from Portland-based organization White Men as Full Diversity Partners. This organization made headlines in July when they were invited by the City of Portland to conduct a 3-day intensive off-site training for 16 white male civic leaders, including Mayor Charlie Hales and Police Chief Mike Reese, as an effort to, quote, address historical, institutional, structural, social, and cultural biases that affect hiring decisions, policy directions, public outreach, budgeting, and innumerable other aspects of governance. Mayor Hales added, "It is important for the police command, which is largely white males, to be able to understand and relate to the diverse communities they serve, and to understand the privileges we enjoy as white men, not through our own efforts, but just because of who we are."
What if you could go beyond an awareness of the commonalities among white women, white men, and people of color? They ask. And the white men, as full diversity partner, know that it's possible to leverage the different perspective, cultures, and unique capabilities of organizations. The mission of white men as full diversity partners is to bring white men wholly on board in diversity efforts. Because a vast majority of American corporations are led by white men, this organization believes that, quote, diversity and inclusion efforts cannot simply be relegated to people of color, white women, and other frequently marginalized groups. They say that, quote, in contrast to the usual check-the-box training and workshops, White Men as Full Diversity Partners provides true solutions that transform the mindsets of leaders and build skills and effectiveness. Their website is www.wmfdp.com.
We are joined by Bill Proudman. He is founding partner of White Men as Full Diversity Partners and the CEO. Bill's diversity journey began in 1987 when he attended a 2-hour presentation on the topic at the suggestion of a friend. It led to a mentoring relationship that fundamentally transformed his life, personally and professionally. Bill pioneered white male-only workshops in the mid-90s after repeatedly noticing that white male leaders disengage from diversity efforts. His provocative work seeded creation of White Men as Full Diversity Partners. We also welcome Henry Marino, Business Development and Marketing Director for White Men as Full Diversity Partners. In his 20-plus career as a marketing professional, Henry worked with global brands in the U.S. and London. Over the last 10 years, Henry has refocused his career to work in the nonprofit sector. Prior to White Men as Full Diversity Partners, he spent 4 years with the Portland Art Museum, driving their media and digital strategy. Currently, he fulfills a long-standing desire to work for an organization with a mission near and dear to his heart, White Men as Full Diversity Partners. Welcome, Bill and Henry.
Welcome,
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks, Leanne and Delphine.
I was wondering if we can start with you, Bill, and really with the founding of the organization. What was the need that you and your co-founders found that really needed to be addressed?
Well, in the early 90s, I was attempting to do diversity and inclusion work, and I was noticing a couple of things, patterns that were happening. Mm-hmm. Number one is I wasn't getting hired. And that might have been because maybe I wasn't very good, but let's assume that I had something to offer. And what I noticed is I wasn't being hired if I was working by myself. If I was paired up with a white woman, man or woman of color, an out gay lesbian colleague, consultant, I'd be hired. So now I'd come and I'd work with, executive teams, men and women, whites, folks of color. And I watched the dynamic happen that I saw, regardless of industry, where on that team, every time issues of difference and diversity and inclusion came up, the team would always outsource the issue to whoever the other was on the team. So if it was there was a couple of white women, they became not just experts about gender inequity, but about all things related to difference, people of color, out gay and lesbian. And so I noticed this pattern where white men looked past each other and always looked to what I call the go-to groups to help them educate, mentor, coach, train, et cetera, et cetera. And I watched the same thing happen for me, which I think is related to why in the early days, I'd call it the potted plant syndrome, where I was in the room, but no one would look to me because the mindset was, I'm a white guy, he doesn't know anything, but thank goodness I was paired with a woman or person of color.
Mm-hmm. And what what led to you guys having conversation. Can you talk a little bit about your co-founders and, you know, how you came together and decided that this was specifically what you wanted to do, training, organized trainings and workshops that were going to talk to white men, to engage them in different ways?
Sure. It was the late 1980s, and I actually went, Leanne, you mentioned it in the lead-in to the show just now, went to a two-hour learning experience at the insistence of a friend of mine. I was doing leadership development work at the time, and I would say I was blissfully unaware in another universe around anything related to equity, privilege, et cetera. I saw myself as a good person, and I knew about those issues, but they were out there. They certainly weren't involved with me. And so this two-hour experience opened what I'd say sort of a parallel door to the other universe of saying all of a sudden there was something related to my skin color, my gender, my sexual orientation, my class upbringing, my educational background, my physical ability down the line that was in part and parcel had me sort of have a, sort of a one-up, sort of like a bunch of benefits that I didn't even know that I had. Mm-hmm. I sort of confused those with I'm just, you know, working hard. Mm-hmm. And that curiosity led into about 6 years of work for me to really rediscover what does it mean for me to be a straight white guy in, you know, in the U.S. at that point in my life, which then created curiosity when I matched that up with what I just said about watching particularly leaders always defer this issue to the other. And I saw that as an unsustainable approach. If part of leadership was deferring this issue to others in leadership, and given the preponderance of white men still, and particularly in the private sector in leadership roles, I don't think we can continue to outsource this issue to those who have been historically marginalized and ask them on top of everything else to then educate and coach me and all the other white guys that are out there. It's just not a sustainable proposition from my perspective.
Mm-hmm. When I dug into your website, I felt like an anthropologist reading some of your materials on white male culture. I thought I had an understanding of white culture, but there's a difference with white male culture. Can you nail that for us?
Yeah. White male culture is even more elusive than I think everything else, because it's a little bit like water that fish swim in. As I always talk to white men, I said, as a white man, as a fish, you know, if a fish had a brain and could speak and you asked it, what do you think of the water? It would likely say, I would just, it's a presumption, obviously, what are you talking about? Because it's never had to leave the water. And if it does leave the water, it's not good for its physical, you know, livelihood. For us as white men, we've largely grown up in a world where all of the mores, behaviors, patterns are just sort of like breathing air. I know the drill. It doesn't mean that I and other white men don't struggle. So this is sometimes a dichotomy for a lot of white men, particularly when I'm working with working class white men and who have a hard time understanding their skin color privilege, because literally they might be one or two paychecks or a loss of a job away from being on the street, losing their home, not being able to provide for themselves and their family. And so this is not about all white men are equal. I think that's the other thing we got to say, is that there's an assumption lots of times that that group is simply all the same and a monolith. And it's much more complex than that. Mm-hmm. So the culture piece about white male culture is really, what are the ways that we operate that actually get generalized onto just the way of operating? So it's not looked at. White male culture is synonymous with American culture, which is synonymous with business organizational culture. And lots of white men in particular sometimes take exception to being singled out as having a culture. They just see it as, well, that's just the way things are.
The right way.
Well, even the right way, and also just, and part of that is if it gets singled out, there's a sense that they're going to get sort of blamed again, which is an interesting, another difficult challenge to sort of overcome.
Yeah, actually, I'm very curious to continue talking a little bit about that. Just the transparency, right? Like that water kind of idea, right? Everything is just so the way it's supposed to be. It's so ingrained that some of us end up not really seeing that. In fact, can you talk a little bit about what you share with the people who attend your workshops? How do you point these different things to them? Can you give some concrete examples?
Like, sure.
Do you talk historically? How does that work?
Actually, we don't do a lot of historical pieces. I think there's a lot of really good sources out there for that. We're really looking at it at a behavioral level, mm-hmm. and particularly for white men. First of all, there's lots. My experience for a lot of white men is that we have what I call a lot of residual scar tissue that we've accumulated over the years, and so there's almost a knee-jerk reflex when someone calls us out as a part of the white male group. There's an assumption that somehow I'm about to pay a price that is going to hurt me, if not physically, of course, but emotionally. I'm going to be blamed for everything that's going on and that's not good in the world. Mm-hmm. And a lot of white men have had enough number of these experiences where they're particularly defended against hearing anything that feels like a personal attack. And so one of the things that I feel really important with our group is that we really help white men understand the paradox of individual group. In other words, that part of U.S., being in the U.S. as a white male, is that we really thrive and value rugged individualism. And as a result of that, we have a hard time seeing group identity issues. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of white men, because they view things through the individual lens, hear about these systemic issues as a personal attack on them, and of course then get a little defensive about it. And they also, I think, sometimes hear individual and group, that paradox is an either or choice. So they feel like they're being asked to give up their individuality to take on this membership in a group that they really fight against being, you know, put into that bucket. Mm-hmm. And I say, not giving up your individuality, but whether you want it or not, you are looked at as a member of a lot of different things. And to not understand that actually complexifies and complicates your partnerships across whatever the difference is. And so it's sometimes a really helpful tool for white men to say, not only are you you're an individual and you're a member of these groups, and because you're a member of these groups, this is not your fault. Mm-hmm. You're responsible for understanding how the historic inequities related to U.S. slavery, for example, mm-hmm. or early inequities for women around voting and, you know, property ownership and all those things, how that might be impacting how you're being heard today in 2014, but it's not your fault. You didn't create that. And so managing that paradox of not feeling blamed for everything is a really liberating way for men to actually stay in the conversation without feeling every tough conversation is somehow going to turn to them being blamed. Mm-hmm. And that can be tough at times to do, because sometimes there is a personal piece to it where the person I'm talking to is saying, Bill, I need to talk to you as an individual, and you are doing this behavior that's really impacting how I'm able to show up or not show up in our relationship, whether it's at work or in our personal life. Most of the time, the group identity work, this is not about me. And I and other white men misinterpret it as about me. And that's where this thing can go off its rails quickly.
Very quickly.
Yeah.
You seem to empower men to understand what they've inherited and what they represent in the world just by what they look like. But you seem to empower them to be able to unpack what they don't buy into. You give them almost an option that, you know, yes, this is your culture, this is where you come from, this is what you represent, but what are you going to buy into and what aren't you going to buy into?
Yeah.
And that exercise, I think, is very important for men to just take a breath, not be in that defensive mode, you know, and be able to have enough breathing room to really figure out where they stand on this stuff.
Well, and that's one of the things where when in the United States in particular, we think about gender in an organization, oftentimes what gets examined are the experiences of who? Women. Mm-hmm. For talking about race, the organization is always talking about the experiences of men and women of color. If we're talking about sexual orientation, we're talking about the experiences of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender folk. And what goes unexamined is what does it mean to be white, male, and heterosexual, mm-hmm. as if mm-hmm. white is not a race, male is not a gender, and heterosexual is not a sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. Or if we do focus on that, there's a concern, because this has happened over time, that again, that those groups are going to be blamed for all of the historic inequity. And while we're certainly at the forefront of causing a lot of barriers and obstacles mm-hmm. for many folk and many groups over the history of civilization, it comes back to saying at a personal level, it's not helpful for me to feel blamed mm-hmm. for the historic inequity and personally disempower myself. Mm-hmm. So a lot of our work is helping men say, you do have a gender. What is your self-interest in gender equity? So this is not about how do I help women with their issue. This is my issue as much as anybody else. So understanding my self-interest really helps me to then better understand how my female colleague or coworker or neighbor or family member or significant other is experiencing the same life scene very differently than I am without saying who's right. Is it me or you? And using sort of a patriarchy piece saying, it's, you know, of course, it's always me and you just need to adjust to my world, which is not usually for, by a lot of men. It's not done consciously, but it doesn't matter because the impact's the same. Other people feel marginalized and invisible, and that is not only fatiguing, but exhausting and unsustainable.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for, you know, the piece about, you know, it's not our fault individually, right? And being able to connect this maybe to also a different, you know, American philosophy of just more individualism, you know? Because I think on the other side, you know, well, marginalized folks are, you know, inheriting also a huge burden of trying to figure out, you know, ways that they can live a fulfilled life when there's lots of things inherited from history and lots of oppression and marginalization. So so I do think that on either side, it's about you know, being able to educate ourselves and acknowledge that that there are some barriers that exist. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much for really putting that in those terms. You're listening to Bread and Roses. We're going to take a short musical break. We'll be back. We are here with Bill Proudman and Henry Moreno, and they are from White Men as Full Diversity Partners, a local organization. They've done work with the city and lots of other organizations and corporations. We are going to listen to the Black Eyed Peas. This is Where Is the Love? Listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo with Leanne Kranz, and we are joined in the studio today by representatives from the Portland-based organization White Men as Full Diversity Partners. Bill Proudman is co-founder, and Henry Moreno is marketing director.
Before the break, we talked at length about some of the ways that white men are defensive and shut down emotionally when we have conversations about white privilege and white male culture, etc. And in this work of white ally work, I would say, you often encounter the term, you know, we need to create a safe place, a safe haven to have these, to initiate these conversations with white people or white men. And to others listening outside of those groups, that concept can be infuriating because, you know, other people don't find safety walking out the door. And so, but you seem to describe creating a safe harbor as a key component to causing men to have transformative learning experiences with your trainings and groups. So can you talk a little bit about why you feel a safe harbor is vital in this work?
Certainly. You know, I have attended two of the more, I'll call, popular programs called White Man's Caucus, which is the group of 16 male individuals in a room for 3.5 days with Bill and or other facilitators. I've also attended as a participant, by the way, you know, not with my marketing hat on, but as a participant, which was really a little bit interesting and a little bit, I was mildly anxious about the process. But to your point about, and I also attended the White Men and Allies, which is the mixed group, white men, people of color, and women. But to your point about the safety, walking into a white man's caucus with 16 white men, 14 to 16 white men, one doesn't start, you know, walking immediately into a safe place. You know, I walk in, I'm sure some of the other men walk in with bias, unconscious bias, judgment, a little trepidation, you know, what this is all about. So it takes about 3 days to fully complete that cycle. And along the way, and Bill can address some of this through awareness exercises, some physical, some mental dialogue between the members where things start opening up. Mm-hmm. And it is transformative. Again, I walked in as a, you know, fairly progressive, open-minded guy, like Bill said earlier, without too much baggage. Mm-hmm. That's my self-delusion, right? And so I walk into that group, and yet I walk in that manner, and yet I walk away with realizations that I never had, you know, the veils lifting day by day, hour by hour. So truly it becomes at the end of that 3 days, you end up, you know, intimate with strangers you only met 3 days ago. And in the second group I mentioned, white men and allies, it was even more remarkable because there were people of color, white men and women. So it was a remarkable experience for on many levels.
Yeah, Leanne and Delphine, what I would add, I think we need to really address, and Henry, I'm sure that listeners, when they hear the words white men's caucus, it's not a positive sounding thing. And that was an intentional choice of words when we first started this work, because historically our group does not have a great track record when we've met behind closed doors. And so there's a natural suspicion, and I get this, and I feel like I understand this. There's a natural suspicion of what possible good could a group of white men meeting on inclusion and diversity without anybody else in the room possibly do? I mean, right? It's a logical conclusion, right?
Yeah.
Right? Because the history of our group doesn't show a lot of positive outcomes for that. And it was exactly because of that history that I said, this is not a sustainable proposition if my learning around equity is always on the hearts, heads, and souls of white women, men and women of color, and out and gay and lesbian folk. If I basically check my brain out and sort of turn to the two of you and say, you are now my exclusive teachers, thank goodness, you're going to help me for the rest of time understand this. When I make a mistake, I'm going to come back to you again and again saying, hey, that didn't quite work. Can you give me 5 new things to do? As if somehow that's your job, which of course it's not. So this work of bringing white men together with other white men is not exclusively, that's the only group we're ever going to meet with, but it's to try to help us do some catch-up work to reconnect with ourselves personally and each other, which then sort of has us realize we know more than we give ourselves credit. We have to and need to show up differently in our partnerships, in this case, across gender with our female colleagues or across race with our colleagues of color. And to change some of that dynamic, like, great, glad you're here, or now we're on a team together, an organization, and all of a sudden you're in charge of the diversity effort because all the white guys just, you know, automatically assume they're clueless because I don't know anything, Henry doesn't know anything, and now you're on the diversity committee. And I, you know, and we've seen this play itself out in the last 20 years where disproportionately the number of people who contact us when we were going to start working in an organization, I'd say 80% of the time are white women and people of color or an out gay and lesbian colleague in a, some leadership role or likely on a diversity council. And they are desperately seeking partnerships with their white male colleagues. Mm-hmm. They've tried everything under the book and they're frustrated, but they haven't given up. And I said, that's our role is saying we have to do some catch up so that we can do this work together rather than, you know, turn it over to you and somehow check out.
Well,
it's
know,
not sustainable.
Going back to the name, which is an issue, of course, and provocative, intentionally so. When I first joined or considered joining the organization as a marketing guy, a branding guy, I was like, okay, got to change that name, you know, from the outside looking in. But I quickly came to realize when you break it down, I like to say that the mission is in our name. Mm-hmm. You know, people get stuck on the first two words, obviously. You should tell your airplane story, Bill. But as you think about it and work through the entire name, you know, mm-hmm. White Men as Full Diversity Partners, it takes on a different spin. Of course, that's part of my role and our role to make mm-hmm. sure we convey the entire story of the organization.
Well, yeah, it's not just on airplanes, but in generally when people don't know who we are and they'll say something like, what do you do for a living? I have an interesting choice point. I can say something esoteric like, I do leadership development work or organizational development work. And that's sort of them left yeah. alone and we have a nice conversation. But if I lead with, I'm a principal, CEO, founder of a firm called White Men as Full Diversity Partners, about 80% of the time that stops the conversation dead right there. I mean, it's just, if I'm on a plane, I'm left alone to sort of do seat work and I'm not bothered. And sometimes I'll joke with people. I said, which of the six words do you have in a reaction to? And it's not the as full diversity partners part. It's the two words white men. Then we usually have a pretty stimulating, provocative conversation. I said, you know, if we had to call ourselves Inclusion Inc. or something, we wouldn't have gotten there so quickly. So, you know, notice that those two words certainly have a trigger. There's a lot of history and there's a lot of energy packed behind that. And a lot of it's not necessarily positive. But I said, part of the privilege I have is basically dictating what I want to be called and what group I want to be referred to. And last time I checked, when the mirror's up, I look in the mirror. I have white skin and I'm male. That's not all of who Bill is, but it's a large. So by reclaiming that membership, I take some power back, personal power back, with being able to say, yeah, I'm willing to have the conversation. Let's talk about that. It's not my fault, but I'm responsible for understanding how the generations of history that my group, from a domination and a sort of invalidation of what we've done at a collective level, if being able to hear how that impacts people that I care about and that I work with, without feeling like I somehow have to fix it, because unfortunately I can't fix it. What I can do is I can validate other people's perspective without feeling like I'm being blamed yet again for the history of this. It's important to then, that changes how we show up in the present day with each other. Mm-hmm. And instead of me, you know, deferring everything to you, we're in a different dialogue. And I hopefully can listen differently. And I don't immediately jump to defending my good guyness when you have something that is irritating of either what I'm, current mannerism or behavior that I'm doing, that's a whole history you have with my group, that I then feel like I'm being personally attacked, when really it's usually not about me. It might be triggered by something I'm doing. And if I don't end up first defending my good intent, I listen differently and I can usually validate. I can say, tell me more about that. How are you experiencing me right now? Without feeling like, oh my goodness, I'll, you know, how could you confuse me? I'm one of the good guys. You know, we get into that whole sort of back and forth thing, which is, I think, not really helpful with
yeah.
how we
yeah.
sort of listen to one another or how I listen to you.
Mm-hmm. All right, part of your curriculum seems to be that you help men, white men in leadership positions, experience, get a sense of what women experience in the workplace, in the world, what people of color experience, what people with different gender or sexual identities experience. So what do you tell them about us? I'm curious, what do you say? How do you get in there and help them get it?
Well, first of all, I don't pretend to be a spokesperson for anybody other than Bill, and I can barely do that on most days, knowing what's going on for me. But what we often do is we'll bring the experiences of other folks into the room through video, and not ask, you know, because no one person speaks for an entire group. what we're inviting men to do is to get curious that their version of the world is not wrong, but it may be incomplete. And because of the vestige of privilege, and we spend a lot of time on privilege because there's a lot of what I call baggage and old barriers, particularly for white men. They see privilege as something that it's been used to sort of bludgeon them in the past. I said, privilege is not so much what I have, it's what I don't have to think about and negotiate on a daily basis. So my life is complex like anybody else, but I don't have to spend as much time generally on a daily basis thinking about, is this experience right now happening to me because I'm in this group? When I have a bad experience at the customer, service counter in a retail shop, I just think they just need customer service refresher training. And it's not, I never think, is this happening to me because I'm a, white guy? Mm-hmm. My colleagues of color and female colleagues, whether it is or it is not, it doesn't matter. It's the fact that it's part of their time and energy is going into
thinking about it.
Yeah, because it's connecting the dots. It happened here. It happened 15 minutes ago. It happened yesterday. It happened at the service station. Mm-hmm. It happened while I was trying to hail a cab. So that's sort of the death by a thousand paper cuts that adds up by themselves. Those small little micro inequities seem almost trivial, but it's the sheer volume of that which I don't have to experience. So we're trying to help guys to see that in very pragmatic ways. It's almost like reawakening from a deep sleep without necessarily then saying, and you somehow need to feel bad about this. What we need to do is we need to be aware of it. When I'm not aware of how privilege is not an equal opportunity, employer, it really gets in my way of marginalizing and minimizing unconsciously the people that I work with, care about, and interact with, and then wonder why their noses are out of joint at me. Mm-hmm. So it can really throw our partnerships for a tizzy. Mm-hmm. And so it's just, it's creating awareness. It's being curious. It's one of the skills is for white guys is we get more comfortable being uncomfortable. I mean, think about that. That's a really important skill. Getting more comfortable being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Rather than every time I ask a question, it's got to have a definitive answer and I got to be told what to do in every situation. No, these issues are complex. I'm never going to understand what it's like to be female on this planet. I'm never going to understand what it's like to be a man or woman of color. I can empathize, but I can get really curious. Tell me more. Mm-hmm. What's going on? How did what I just do impact you? Here was my intention. Did it match what the impact was? Mm-hmm. Oh, it didn't? Wow. Isn't that interesting? Tell me more. And then to sort of connect the dots, look for those patterns without then blaming myself that I'm somehow this monster that is, intentionally doing these things to people that I work with, live near and also care about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's very much about being able to find, to understand, how your actions and the impact that they have on the people around you, and especially when your desired outcome is not to hurt someone, being able to ask those questions and have those conversations, I think it's very important. Mm-hmm. Henry, would you share with us a little bit more about your experience? So what were you expecting to learn going in? Or did you think, I know everything about everything?
No,
I don't have to learn anything.
No, certainly not the latter. But I didn't know quite what to expect.
Okay.
I'd started drinking the Kool-Aid and reading and learning and researching about ourselves and our past work. But really didn't know what to expect. I'm aware of, my personal experience of like work is usually about, a person. It's about me, mm-hmm. some sort of retreat or leadership training or what have you. But this took on a whole different flavor for mm-hmm. reasons we've already been speaking about. So I can tell you that I think the most impactful and memorable one for me was the White Men and Allies, mm-hmm. where, again, there were people of mixed gender, color and sexuality. And I walked in there curious and anxious to really try to understand the differences in the room and the experiences and the cultures, et cetera, et cetera. And I came away with, because again, I've always considered myself, and I believe I am progressive and liberal and, you know, a student of history and culture and pretty well informed about all of the above. But my experiences in that group, you know, learning what I learned, hearing people of color speak passionately and women speak passionately, really took me aback day one. You know, I was a bit apprehensive. You know, I was like, okay, I'm going to sit back the rest of these next 2 days. But little by little, I found the courage, as recommended or as inspired by the work happening in the room, to step out a little bit. And I think the biggest eye-opener for me was the intimacy that was created by one being courageous. You step out and somebody steps in. You step out more, somebody else steps in. And some of the work involves small circle work, we call it. Five or six people in a small round. The whole room is in a circle. Then there's an inner circle for certain exercises. And that is about confronting each other. You know, to Bill's point a minute ago, well, tell me how that impacted on you, you know? And we all occasionally would write questions to facilitate or trigger a dialogue. And it was through that dialogue or process after the second or third day that I walked away with, wow, never considered that. Never even considered the simplicity of my point of view and how it was, how it impacted or how people of color or women may have perceived it completely different.
I'm just very curious if you would share maybe, you know, one thing that you stopped doing or that you started doing right after this workshop.
Well, on a trivial matter, you know, I'm constantly with men or women, young or middle-aged or old, will always come out and say, hi, guys, or bye, guys, or how you guys doing? You know, and it's, well, it's just kind of a social greeting, and it's pretty acceptable, I think, by all. But that was my presumption. How do I know what women really feel about that? And of course, some of that came up in the office as I was sharing what I had intuited or experienced. Long story short, I don't say that anymore. You know, I just say hello and I'll make a joke about it, you know.
Hello,
but
everyone.
That's one trivial thing.
And it is trivial, but unfortunately, as Bill was mentioning, those microaggressions that, you know, those micro marginalization that happen for some individuals on a daily basis. I love the image of death by a thousand paper cuts. I really like that image because I have had friends tell me that that's what it feels. And as a woman, I have felt at times this way. You know, this is a wonderful conversation. We're going to continue this conversation after a short musical break. So I wanted to play for you a French song. I don't do it very often. This is my favorite singer, Francis Cabrel. And the song we're going to hear is about our humanity, that we are all humans the same. I'm Delphine Crescenzo with Leon Kranz. You are listening to Bread and Roses. We'll be back in a minute.
Vous êtes et nous sommes des hommes pareils, plus ou moins nus sous le soleil, même cœur entre les mêmes épaules. Qu'est-ce qu'on vous apprend à l'école? Si on y oublie l'essentiel, on partage le même royaume. Où vous êtes et nous sommes. Moi j'ai des îles, j'ai des lacs. Moi j'ai trois poissons dans un sac. Moi je porte un crucifix. Moi je prie sur un tapis. Moi je règne et je décide. Moi j'ai quatre sous de liquide. Moi je dors sur des bambous. Moi je suis docteur marin. Et nous sommes des hommes pareils, plus ou moins loin du soleil. Blanc, noir, rouge, jaune, créole, qu'est-ce qu'on vous apprend à l'école?
il y manque l'essentiel, semblable jusqu'au moindre atome. Vous, vous êtes, et nous, nous sommes. Moi, je me teins et je me farde, moi, mes chiens montent la garde. Moi, j'ai piégé ma maison, moi, je vis sous les cartons. Moi, j'ai 100 ans dans 2 jours, moi, j'ai jamais fait l'amour. Nous, enfants, neveux et nièces, on dort tous dans la même pièce.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. This was Francis Cabrel, Des Hommes Pareils. We are human, just the same. No matter how much worth we think we have, we live in the same aquarium and we share the same kingdom where we are and you are human the same. That's what he says. Henry?
You know, during the break, I was thinking about my comment about, hey, guys, and I labeled it trivial.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm realizing it's trivial in my mind.
Yes.
So I project that it's trivial for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's an example of a little paper cut. And so, mm-hmm. point made.
Yes.
It's interesting how you flip things mm-hmm. in the perspective and a kind of another approach comes up.
Mm-hmm. So I now, say guys all the time. I'm questioning myself now.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Good.
I think it's charged differently though.
Right.
You know,
it's a
whether
matrix.
It's
yeah,
you
it's
all or I or male or female mm-hmm. use the term.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah, this is Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Christian. Leanne Kranz is with me, and we have Bill Proutman and Henry Moreno in the studio, and we've been talking about their organization, White Men as Full Diversity Partners. Bill, during the break, you started talking, you know, as Henry just mentioned, those, you know, quote-unquote trivial, you know, things. And you mentioned one of the things that, you know, guys like to do, which is give people nicknames.
Yeah, I mean, it's under the realm of banter, and for a lot of white men, we're schooled early on, instead of talking to each other and showing our affection by saying, I really love you,
mm-hmm.
we'll give each other grief. We'll, you know, give it better than we get it, all that sort of one-upsmanship stuff, and almost to the point when women in my life in particular look in on that and they see us doing that, they're like, why do you treat each other so badly? And we say, what are you talking about? We're sometimes not even aware. So anyway, we got talking over break, and this is about 15 years ago, working with a client. It's a hydropower operation in the rural part of the West. And we were working with a group of white men at the time, and they realized on their project with about 180 guys, because there was the 20 women that worked at this project, 19 of them worked in front office jobs. Only one other woman worked in the powerhouse. So it was all guys and one woman in the powerhouse with this hydro project. And the guys all had nicknames for each other. And of course, if you protested your nickname, that was just a
you
license.
Got it double.
They're asking
yeah,
for
you,
it.
You got it even more, right? So from this work, these four guys went to one of these sessions. They came back and they said, you know, what we call each other or what we want to be called and how that's respected by our colleagues is really a sign of respect. And mm-hmm. so they went back and they said, there were two men of color on this project, so they were all white guys. And one was an American Samoan guy, and his nickname was Junior. And they went to Junior, who had been Junior for 20 years, and said, Junior, what we would like you to call you what you would like to be called. What would you like to be called?
Oh, my goodness.
And, of course, Junior says, what?
His
Junior.
Oh.
Yeah, why? Because he's been Junior for 20 mm-hmm. years, and he was thinking, they're just trying to pull my chain, right?
Yeah.
So they stayed at Junior for about the next 2 or 3 weeks, like to sort of break down that they were somehow pulling a fast one on him.
Mm-hmm.
So then it was, well, then he said, well, my given name is Ceylani, and, you know, it's not that difficult. So he was then Ceylani. And then this is the next piece. There was a Mexican-American man on this project, and his nickname was Taco.
Oh, my God.
Right? And these guys said, that's got to stop. And so they asked him. And then here's one of the most fascinating things was they realized then they all had nicknames for each other. And so he started to go one at a time, white male to white male, what would you like to be called? And this was profound in some ways, but it was so decentering that actually some of the more toxic white men took over the union. This was a unionized environment, and accused management of using diversity as a wedge issue to try to break the union. Mm-hmm. It was and to the credit of the guy that ran that project at the time, he stayed with it. And it wasn't just about names. It was about, really, it was a culture shift about mm-hmm. how do we want to show respectful behavior to each other. And so much of white male culture is sort of suck it up, show no chinks in the armor, run silent, run deep. It's only a flesh wound. You know, don't let them see any pain, because that will just sort of create. That's, I mean, we're human beings. We have feelings, all of us, not just some, all of us. And that was real. I mean, it brought tears to my eyes to watch. And that was a very simple thing. What would you like to be called? But that is very, very important. And that, of course, that led to lots of other conversations that had never been in that system before. And they worked through the some that were really decentered by the shift in behavior, which change does decenter some folks. Even good change is, you know, because human beings, we're not really used to change. We've got to adjust to it. It takes time sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I just have to say, I've kind of been silenced by, just been thoughtful through this conversation. It's very clear what comes up again and again is that white men, as you mentioned just a minute ago, you have a surface, this take charge, bravado, everything, I'm handling it, I'm strong, I'm solid, but it's just a mask. Beneath that, there seems to be so much fear and pain and vulnerability, and I don't think we outside of that loop, I don't think we know that. Yeah, I don't think we see that as strongly as it is. We feel the brunt of it, but we don't know necessarily the source.
Right, and Leanne, that brings another story that about 8-9 years ago, we were working in one of the energy companies, large energy companies in the Houston area, and it was a group of men, many of which had worked at this one company for 20-25 years. Most of them were in the IT area. And I'll never forget this. There were three guys. They turned to each other in a course of a large conversation. And one guy said to the other, he said, I didn't realize you were having trouble in your marriage until the picture of your wife was no longer in your desk. And this guy had gone through about 3 years of struggle in the relationship. Of course, never told a soul at work that was going on. They got separated, eventually divorced. And the third guy in this group, who was in tears at this point, when he could speak, he said, for the last 5 years, I've been treated for clinical depression. And I've never told a soul at work because I'm afraid if you find out that you're not going to give me the next project assignment or whatever that is. So here's a guy with a chemical imbalance in his body that is not, he didn't choose to do this. He's fearful for his livelihood, losing his job, his promotability. And that is not helpful for how he is dealing with getting this chemical imbalance taken care of. And that was this great example of, you know, the aura of invincibility that a lot of young boys and then men and then white men in particular take on, like, I don't need no stinking help, I can do it all by myself, asking for help is a sign of weakness. That's where I don't like making comparative statements, but one of the ones that I do make occasionally is I think white men have as much, if not more, to gain out of greater inclusion than almost any other group, because we're the last to know it, because we're the ones that we think we're supposed to sit there and just sort of deal with all it ourselves, not ask for any help. And I went through this. And there's a piece of that I love around my tenacity and my toughness. But the reality is, I'm in relation with everything on this planet, and starts with other people. And to think that I don't need anything from anybody is a fallacy, and actually not good for my physical, mental, and emotional health. And so, we've had the great joy in the last 20 years of watching white men reclaim that part of their humanity in the service to create more equitable organizations, which start out as we're here to help those people with their issues and turns into saying, this issue is about me and my group, and there are some things that I've unconsciously done that have really invalidated these other colleagues. When I stop that, I also get something back in return for myself.
Yeah, and I'd love if you could talk a little bit about that, about the transformations, because really you set out to show people that there is something to gain for the organization also in being able to understand all the different perspectives that are being brought by having a diverse team. So would you talk a little bit about, you know, what are these benefits that exist, but then also what are the other benefits that people get at the individual level and the way they carry themselves in their lives?
Sure. Most of our work over the last 20 years has been in the private sector and corporate America. And corporate America, which has been very cost conscious, has had a trend where they've continued to ask people to do more with less full-time equivalent. So my experience watching work cycles in the last 30 years is that people in work environments are doing much more than they used to ever do. And it's sort of like being on a treadmill that has slowly been punched up from 5 to 6 to 7 to 15. And so the pace is quickened. Mm-hmm. And our bodies and psyches are not equipped to handle this. But we've done it so long, so often, that we think that we are. So one of the great benefits around this is it's actually, this work is incredibly liberating. So if I am able to, first of all, say, I will say and do some things that unintentionally marginalize and hurt others, and that's not an excuse, but it helps me not to feel like somebody's just supposed to give me the answer card so I never say anything that invalidates another person. I know I have the ability, when we metaphorically fall down and skin our knees with one another, to reach out a hand and help someone to be picked up, triaged, put a bandage on that. And sometimes I'm the perpetrator of the scrape. And that is really liberating, which is different than, because I went to the 3-day training, I'll never make another mistake in my life.
Yeah, no, that's
and
not
I'll never
true.
Say something that, you know, lands in a way that I didn't intend for a colleague. So it actually gives us more resiliency to hang in there with each other when inevitable mess-ups occur. Because after all, we're human beings. We're not chemical equations. When we come together, you know, sort of like the movie Crash, we mm-hmm. crash into each other, and it's yeah. our capacity to be able to recover from those things, which I believe is as important as trying to set an environment up where we're never going to say or do anything yes. that is misperceived by a colleague. And there are lots of things that we need to continue to do to reduce the amount of unintended atrocity that we, inflict on each other, no matter how well-intended I might be. Mm-hmm. And there's no there with that. That, I mean, I'm going to be learning that, how to undo that, till the day I check off the planet and go someplace else, right? Mm-hmm. So this is not about perfection. It is about practice, and it's about being rigorous. So being willing to hang in there, seeing self-interest, knowing that I can make mistakes and they're not going to be cataclysmic. Like, think about anything that's important to you that you ever learned. You've certainly made mistakes. And if you can't make mistakes, how do you
learn?
Yeah, you got to be out on your edge, right? Rather than just doing everything that is never going to, you know, cause a problem. I also think it raises the ability for us to be able to wade into and initiate difficult conversations, since there are many difficult issues facing us as a community, as a global community, as a local community. To put that into the hands of some rather than all of us, sort of, again, it's a privilege for me to sort of outsource that to others. So no, how do I initiate and engage others in difficult conversations where sometimes it's actually my actions or the things that we need to be talking about? So that all of that is important, and it makes the difficult easier. Mm-hmm. Doesn't eliminate difficult; it just makes it easier. And I've seen this happen time and time again in the last 20 years, which is, I think, really vital for us as a species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and thank you for saying that there's no, I will never make a mistake card. There's no like, you know, here's the solution, just do this and everything will be perfect from now on. It's actually our ability to be vulnerable and to be in that moment of, oh, I'm uncomfortable, I just did something that I wish I had not, that's going to help you understand, so that, you know, hopefully next time you don't do it. And even if you do it again, it will still be an opportunity for you to continue to learn onwards.
Let me add one more thing, because I've been noticing in our time so far, we've been talking obviously about white men, since that's the two words in the name of our company. Our company actually also works with white women and men and women of color. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happens is when I and other white men start to understand our renewed stake and role in our partnerships, it actually frees up some time and energy for women and people of color to re-examine their assumptions about my group and then how it impacts their partnerships with me and other white guys. So our work really is with courageous leaders, many of which are white men, but are also white women, yes. people of color. We all have work to do. Sometimes the work is similar, sometimes it's different, hence why some of the work only white male to white male is important, because mm-hmm. it sets up the work across those differences, just like it's important for other groups to sort of caucus together. And those times are precious and needed from my perspective, because it informs how we then come together differently.
Right.
What a wonderful conversation it's been. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. So I wanted to thank you both, Henry Moreno and Bill Proutman, for being with us this evening.
And thanks for having us.
And for the work you do.
Yes, thank you for what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And when will you be working with our federal government?
we're starting local, then we're going to move up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both for inviting us.
So again, the website is www.wmfdp.com. That's at wmfdp.com. Thank you all for listening. Thanks for tuning in to Bread and Roses. We are a collective of women identified radio activists, and we are here every Friday at 6. Thank you, Leanne.
Thank you, Delphine.
Thank you, Brooke, for engineering. And we're going to leave you with a song by Rose Band, local female hip-hop group. A New Tomorrow is the name of the song. And this is a farewell song to Jackie, one of the singer of Rose Band that's moving on from Portland. We'll miss you in Portland, Jackie. Take care, everyone. Have a good week.
Away your tears, dry your eyes, moving up and on a new tomorrow.
Mama screamed in the hall, what's that? Daddy put his hands back on mama, slap, slap. Those were the times when I wish I had a gap. Put the gap to the tip with a pillow, pap, pap. But that's not the life for me. If I learned anything, it was how to succeed. Ain't nobody finna take away from what I believe, because they are afraid that will never be me. When daddy left, he didn't say I'm leaving. Left up to him, man, I wouldn't be breathing. Yet I'm steady achieving, planting the seeds in the minds of the future, changing the seasons. What's the reason? Our hearts are bleeding, concern for the youth and how we leave them. You better think about it before you speak about it. Use your action, not your words, how we be about it.
KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Coming up next is Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop, so keep it locked.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor
Negative Lounge.
Performing live Friday, August 29th at the Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside in Portland.
We got so much power.
How many time zones there are in the Soviet Union?
Since 1980, Negative Land has been creating records, CDs, video, fine arts, books, radio, and live performance using appropriated sounds, images, objects, and texts.
Negative Land will be performing with Daniel Mensch and Cascadian Knights. All ages welcome.
Not even funny.
Again, that's Negative Land. Friday, August 29th at the Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside in Portland.
More information can be found at KBOO.FM on the right side of the home.